Funding for Think comes from SMU Continuing and Professional Education.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. Debates about the ethics of execution are not new, even in states like Texas, where it remains firmly entrenched as a punishment option for the most violent offenders. But there's a new wrinkle to the discussion these days. The drugs used in the lethal injection cocktail are getting harder to come by, and there are serious doubts as to whether new preparations used as substitutes are effective and painless. Journalist Jeffrey E. Stern explores this very complex situation and some of the cases it has affected in his article, The Execution of Clayton Lockett, which is the cover story in the June issue of The Atlantic magazine. Jeff, welcome to Think.
Thank you. It's good to be here.
We should be entirely clear here, as you are in the piece, that Clayton Lockett did a horrible thing. Tell us about the crime that got him sentenced to death in the first place.
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there was never any doubt about his guilt, even from his own attorneys, which is one of the reasons why we chose this as kind of the acid test for lethal injection. But he essentially presided over a night of just complete terror for three young people in Oklahoma that resulted in one woman being murdered, one woman being raped, and another being just viciously beaten.
And the woman who was murdered was actually buried alive.
I'm sorry, I didn't. You cut out there.
Oh, I was saying the woman who was murdered was actually buried alive.
That's right. Yeah, she was shot twice. She was actually shot once. The gun jammed. He cleared the jam, shot her again, and she still wasn't dead. She was buried alive. She died later that evening.
Okay, so this happened in 1999. Lockett was convicted and sentenced the following year, meaning he was on death row in Oklahoma for 14 years. First of all, are such delays typical to every state that practices the death penalty?
Well, there's a long series of appeals, and, you know, especially when a state chooses the ultimate punishment, there are a lot of hoops that the state has to jump through in order to bring the person finally to the execution chamber.
Mm-hmm. How did death penalty states, including Oklahoma, switch from electrocution to lethal injection as the primary means of killing convicted criminals?
Well, I think, you know, we as a society, sort of every generation, believe that we've found a more quote-unquote humane way to carry out the death penalty. And I think for our generation, the fact that lethal injection looks clinical, looks almost medical, was something that was, I think, widely appealing.
Yeah, there's a doctor in the room who doesn't necessarily administer the medications or whatever. I don't know if you call them medications in this case, but doesn't administer the drugs but is present.
That's right, yeah. I mean, the optics are really important. The person is on a, you know, there's white sheets. The person is in scrubs. As you said, there's a doctor present. So the whole optic of the situation is created in order to make it look essentially medical.
Okay, so explain, Jeff, how this works. There's a three-drug cocktail given to the condemned person in sequence.
Sorry, you cut out again.
Oh, all right. Let's see if we can fix that. We can maybe take a quick break here and see if we can get this signal fixed so
okay.
You can hear me. Okay, just hang on. Just
all right,
hold
thanks.
With us.
Okay.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Jeffrey E. Stern. His article, The Execution of Clayton Lockett, is the cover story in the June issue of The Atlantic magazine. We'll take a short break here and come right back.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jeffrey E. Stern. His article, The Execution of Clayton Lockett, is the cover story in the June issue of The Atlantic. It looks at the death penalty through the lens of what has widely become known as the botched execution in Oklahoma last year of a man named Clayton Lockett. Jeff, let's come back to our conversation. You can hear well now.
I can hear you. Yeah, thank you.
Good. Excellent. Okay. So we were talking about this. There is a three-drug cocktail given to a condemned person in a particular sequence. Explain for us what each drug is meant to do.
Right. So the first drug is meant to effectively put the offender to sleep. So that's a sedative of some sort. And the second drug is a muscle relaxant, or otherwise known as a paralytic. And it's meant to literally paralyze the person. And then the third drug is potassium chloride, and that essentially stops the sodium-potassium shift that makes the heart pump. So that should stop the heart as if flipping a switch.
And if there is a paralytic and an anesthetic, it would seem like maybe they do the same thing, but a paralytic doesn't dull the pain?
Well, right. That's a great point. I mean, one of the questions that's been brought up by opponents of the death penalty is why use a paralytic? If the sedative is effective, if the person is unconscious, why would you need to paralyze them? And the answer for them is it's cosmetic. It's because of the person is experiencing some kind of discomfort. This way, we don't see it.
Hmm. All right. So who decides what specific drugs will be used in that 3-drug cocktail?
Well, sometimes it's lawyers. It's attorneys for the state, attorney general, attorney for the office, the Department of Corrections. It's not people generally with a lot of medical expertise or any medical training at all. There's very few medical professionals who are comfortable being involved in this. And so often it's essentially lawyers deciding based on what's worked in the past.
Hmm. And that means, I mean, experimentation would be the wrong word here, but it's hard to get something new because no one really knows how a different preparation might function.
Right, exactly. They're really uncomfortable trying new things because, again, they have very little reason for confidence that it will work besides the fact that it's worked in the past. So when there have been drug shortages, the first response has been to try whatever they can do to get a hold of the same drug somewhere else.
Jeff, lots of people have heard about these drug shortages and I think are a little bit confused about them. Why? How do states acquire the drugs used in executions and why are some of them suddenly in short supply?
Well, it really began in 2009 when a company called Hospira Pharmaceuticals that was making a cheap off-patent anesthetic called sodium thiopental had some problems in one of their production lines. And they had to shut it down at the time just temporarily to address this issue. When they shut it down, sodium thiopental was suddenly unavailable from what was the only FDA-approved supplier actually making the drug. So what states did is a lot of them began looking overseas, first to England, then actually ultimately to India to try to get a hold of this same drug. Eventually, they got that supply also dried up because that was really illegal. This is where the prisons became almost drug smugglers because they were bringing in drugs that were not FDA approved, and they began experimenting with new drugs finally.
Hmm. And the reason that it's illegal to import these drugs from Europe or from the companies that they were supplying from is because the death penalty is illegal there.
Well, right. So one of the first places they looked was England, where there's a pharmaceutical distributor that was bringing in sodium thiopental from other countries and then shipping them out to U.S. execution states. One of the anti-death penalty advocates based in England found out about this and basically said to the English government, we don't have the death penalty. This is illegal. We need to put an export ban on these drugs. And ultimately that happened in England. And then actually they added that drug as a ban to that drug as part of the torture regulation, the European Commission.
What sort of therapeutic medical market is there for sodium thiopental? Why does it exist at all?
Well, so it's a very cheap and pretty effective anesthetic drug, a surgical drug that's used now really mostly in the developing world. There's a huge demand for it in Africa, in sub-Saharan Africa. It's just not used very commonly in the West and certainly not in America. It's used. It's just not very common, and most doctors have many other drugs they would prefer. And most pharmaceutical companies don't really make it because it's off patent. There's not a huge profit margin in it.
So there was a company based in Mumbai that made sodium thiopental for export to Angola. The U.S., a number of states were trying to acquire the medication from that company. They decided to try to put these states off by charging like 9 times the regular amount for the drug. What was the response to that?
The states paid it. States have paid a lot of money to get these execution drugs.
The next step was to go to places called compounding pharmacies. For people who are not familiar, why do these places exist in addition to the pharmacies where most of us get our prescriptions?
Well, so the idea behind compounding pharmacies is that if there is a niche need for a drug or, for example, a kind of drug that's widely available but that there's some additive that a patient might be allergic to. So a compounding pharmacy will basically synthesize that drug but make it for a very small market. The problem is there's not a ton of oversight, and they're not quite overseen by the state, not quite regulated by the federal government, and so it became a problem of potential contamination.
We are speaking with journalist Jeffrey E. Stern, who wrote the cover story for the June issue of The Atlantic magazine. It's called The Execution of Clayton Lockett. If you'd like to be part of our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org or find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K through 12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd. We're speaking this hour with journalist Jeffrey E. Stern, who wrote the cover story for the June issue of The Atlantic. It's called The Execution of Clayton Lockett. If you'd like to join our conversation, you can call 1-800-933-5372, or you can email think@kera.org. So, Jeff, it turns out to have been a pretty complicated thing to know exactly what was going on with the death penalty in Oklahoma because of a state law.
Yeah, that's right. So Oklahoma passed a law in 2011 that made virtually every aspect of executions essentially a state secret. So it became exceedingly difficult, if not impossible, to find out what the drugs were, where they were coming from, who was making them, information that to attorneys representing death row inmates was really important to make sure that their clients were not going to be killed by potentially cruel and unusual means.
Why would the state pass a law like that?
Well, I think it had a lot to do with the fact that as more and more attention and the light was being shown on executions and particularly who was supplying the drugs, drug suppliers were beginning to get a little bit leery of being involved. For everyone from compounding pharmacies, as we were just talking about, to some of the bigger pharmaceutical companies that had been almost inadvertently supplying executions. So I think the state really wanted to shield those organizations from attention in order to make it possible to get execution drugs. And I think their calculus was that as long as it was possible or at least easy to find out where drugs were coming from, it would be hard to get drugs. Those suppliers would not want to cooperate.
Who was put in charge of hunting down a substitute drug to use in Oklahoma executions, including the execution of Clayton Lockett?
Well, it was supposed to be kind of a team effort between the Attorney General and the Attorney General's office, I should say, and the General Counsel for the Department of Corrections, a guy named Mike Oakley. But it kind of fell on the General Counsel to come up with a solution when, at the last minute, a drug they'd been using called pentobarbital became unavailable.
So Oakley was aware of a drug called midazolam. I can never tell how to pronounce these.
That's right,
medicines.
Yeah. We say midazolam.
Midazolam. Okay, so how did he know about this drug and think maybe this would work?
Well, it had been used a couple of times in other states. The executions in other states had not gone totally according to plan. He had been told by some of his colleagues, and he looked into this because he was concerned about some of the reports he'd heard. And I should say, midazolam is easier to get. One of the reasons it was appealing was because, whereas some of the other drugs they were using were almost impossible to get, midazolam was made by a number of FDA-approved manufacturers and was relatively widely available. So when he went looking into this drug, he heard reports of what had happened in other states. It had been used two or maybe three times, and there had been some problems. In one case, there had been the offender had gasped on the gurney. In another, it just simply took longer than it was supposed to, and so he asked about that. And what he was told was that the media was exaggerating these reports, that midazolam works. It takes a little bit longer to sedate a person, but that ultimately it's perfectly acceptable. And so they ended up choosing midazolam.
And Clayton Lockett was the first Oklahoma condemned person to be given midazolam?
Mm-hmm.
Okay. I want to warn people that this will be a somewhat graphic description, but tell us about what happened in the execution room that day.
Yeah, so, I mean, the problems began almost immediately. And even before the drugs were injected, the first thing that they have to do is to place an IV. And this is generally a pretty routine procedure. I mean, anyone in the medical field will tell you that this is a relatively easy thing to do. Clayton Lockett had excellent veins. And instead of taking a few seconds or maybe a minute, they ended up taking the better part of an hour and trying 16 different times to place an IV, including some fairly invasive procedures, central venous catheterization, which goes behind the collarbone. And they ended up selecting a femoral vein, which is in the groin. And so another one of the problems was that they did not have the appropriate equipment. So they used a needle which was really inappropriately short. I think it was almost doomed from the beginning. The needle was way too short. And even before the drugs were administered, I think it was at risk of coming out.
Who was in charge of administering these drugs?
Well, so there's a kind of an elaborate, almost Rube Goldbergian setup where you have a paramedic who's known as the IV team leader, and it was supposed to be her job to place the IV. There's a doctor there who, according to the protocol, is allowed to assist in the placement of the IV, but that's not really supposed to happen. Doctor is really supposed to be there just observing, checking for consciousness, and then declaring time of death. What happened in this case is that the paramedic was struggling and asked for help from the doctor. The doctor, who was a last-minute substitute, decided he had no other choice but to help place the IV. Once the IV is placed, then the IV goes into a separate room that's called the chemical room or the executioner's chamber, or known colloquially as the closet, where the executioners stay. They remain anonymous. They're out of view. And they inject the drugs, which are labeled 1A, 1B, and then a saline drip, and then 2A, 2B, and et cetera, which corresponds with the drugs that they're supposed to use.
So if everything had gone according to plan, it would have taken how long between the moment the first drug was pushed and the time of death?
Well, before midazolam, the executions that have gone, you know, quote unquote, well, the time of death has been declared within 5 or 6 minutes. The executions with midazolam have all taken a little bit longer, but 10 or 15 minutes would have been the outside of what was normal, what was expected.
It took the better part of an hour, as you said, for Clayton Lockett to be declared dead. And what did that hour look like?
Well, so almost immediately, as was, you know, potentially expected, when the executioners began injecting the first drug, which again was midazolam, the IV infiltrated, which means it was no longer in the vein in his groin. It was just pouring the drugs into the tissue. What that meant is that he was not getting the dose that people thought he was getting. He was getting a highly diluted dose as it was reabsorbed into his bloodstream, and he just did not go to sleep. And it became very clear that it was taking too long. At the 5-minute mark, they checked for consciousness. The doctor declared him not unconscious. And then 2 minutes later, he went and checked again. And at that point, he decided that he was, that Clayton Lockett was indeed unconscious, and that they could begin administering the other drugs, the paralytic and then the potassium chloride. When they began administering the potassium chloride, Lockett began to struggle.
Which is a sign that he is not unconscious and certainly not out of pain.
Yeah, correct. And he likely was, as they administered the paralytic, I mean, that certainly had some effect. That, too, of course, would have not been going directly into his bloodstream. So he would not have been getting the dose that everyone believed he was getting. But that doesn't mean there was no effect. There likely was some effect. So what was seen by the witnesses and by the people in the death chamber was likely some a muted version of what Lockett was feeling.
So, Jeff, as you know, you're speaking to an audience that is largely in Texas. There are many people here who might say a painless death is, not so necessary for a person who has caused great pain. But can you talk a little bit about the constitutional prohibition on cruel and unusual punishment and how that is brought to bear in lethal injection?
I think it's a good point also, and I'd like to address that. We've gotten some comments, people saying what you just implied. You know, this is maybe he deserved to be tortured more. He did a terrible thing. How is this execution botched? He died in the end, and if it was painful, all the better. And I find that a little bit just personally find it a little bit upsetting, but also those people who are saying that are seem to be relatively clear-eyed. They're not hiding from what actually happened here. And in a way, I think there's more kind of intellectual honesty in that approach than some others, because you're saying, yeah, okay, this isn't painless. This isn't the clinical procedure we believe it to. We have been told it is, but still we support it. And I completely respect that opinion. There is, as you say, a constitutional ban in the Eighth Amendment on cruel and unusual punishment, and I think that's where we need to answer. I mean, if this is indeed cruel and unusual punishment, and I think that, I mean, in this case, there's an argument to be made that it was certainly, that's illegal. That's against the Constitution, and we'll hear about that when the Supreme Court makes its decision in June.
All right, talk about that. This has been challenged, obviously, posthumously for Clayton Lockett, but tell us about that case.
So the case it's a fairly narrow case. It's challenging the use of midazolam, and it may be a very narrow ruling. They may rule entirely just based on whether this one particular drug, rather than, say, lethal injection or the death penalty, is cruel and unusual. But, you know, that may lead to a broader discussion. If midazolam is found to be unconstitutional, then states are going to be sent scrambling again.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go on the phone now to James in Hearst. Hello, James.
Hello. I'm not necessarily for the death penalty, but I'm curious, with all the issues in getting these drugs, why don't they go back to the older methods before we had that, like firing squads and nooses? I'm not for it, but those were ways that we used to kill people, and now we're scrambling for all these, like, clean clinical approaches.
What do you know about that, Jeff?
Well, I think that's a really good question. I think that, as the caller said, they're clean and clinical, or at least they appear to be. And I think that may be what most of us want. I think maybe I think there's a strong argument to be made that those other methods would be more effective and more humane, but they don't look it. I mean, it's a very dramatic thing, a firing squad, a hanging. You know, in fact, that was part of the point, right? It was the spectacle of it in terms of deterrence. And I think maybe, and this is entirely speculation, but maybe we as a society are at the point where we don't want the spectacle of it, but we still want to have this as punishment. I don't know. I don't have a good answer to that question. I think that's a great question.
What was the effect on the witnesses who were there in the viewing area the day that Clayton Lockett was put to death?
Yeah, that's another really important question. I mean, I think it's easy to lose sight of that because of the spectacle of what happened to Clayton Lockett. But this was an intensely disturbing experience for everyone that was there. Certainly the people in the room, the warden and the paramedic and the doctor, also witnesses in the witness viewing area. It's important to note that they only saw, the witnesses only saw about half of what happened. They didn't know what happened prior to the blinds coming up, which means they didn't know at the time that there had been all this problem with the IV. And when Lockett started to move, eventually the warden decided to put the blinds down. And then after that, what happened in the death chamber, nobody saw that either. But even what they were able to see was enough that many of the journalists there were very disturbed. The family of the victims were very disturbed. You know, as you would expect, they had seen someone essentially close his eyes and then wake up. One of the witnesses described it as like a horror movie, that when the doctor went over to check the IV, one of the witnesses said that Lockett opened his eyes, looked right at the doctor, and said something's wrong. So, I mean, you can imagine it's intensely traumatic for everyone that was there.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Austin on the line next in Dallas. Hello, Austin.
Oh, hi. Wow, great, great topical discussion. I have a question. You're talking about how our Bureau of Prisons is importing and almost basically smuggling drugs in around the FDA's nose there. And my question is, have we ever used those kind of smuggled in drugs to execute someone who's on death row for a drug trafficking related offense?
Yeah, I don't know the answer to that. That's something to look into. Making a note right now.
I think you have to have killed someone, though, don't you? I mean, if it's just drug trafficking and there's not a harm, direct harm to another person, I don't think any states have capital punishment.
For drug smuggling, I don't know the answer to that.
We have an email here from Nina who asks, why can't the drugs used to tranquilize and euthanize animals be used?
Oh, they were.
Yeah.
So after this drug that we were talking about at the beginning, sodium thiopental, which was the, you know, the cheap anesthetic that was widely available until this contamination in the filling lines, one of the first drugs that they shifted to was called pentobarbital. And when they were, when states, including Oklahoma, asked for permission to use this drug, one of the things they said was, this is ideal for euthanasia in animals. That's one of the ways they got the idea to use it.
Can you talk about some of the, I don't know that they were mitigating circumstances in the crime itself, but what sort of evidence did the defense team present to try to give context to the crime that Lockett committed?
Well, right. I mean, of course, it's important to note that not everyone who's had a really tragic childhood turns out to be a murderer or a violent criminal, but Clayton Lockett really had a particularly rough childhood, and he had been essentially abandoned by his mother at the age of three, sent across the country to live with his father. His father was abusive physically and arguably sexually. He sat the kids down to watch pornography when they were very young. He, you know, blew marijuana smoke up their nose when they were five or six. Clayton Lockett was raped when he was five, allegedly, according to stepmother. He moved back to Oklahoma, was involved in some petty crime, was in an adult penitentiary for the first time at 16, was immediately raped again, and he essentially came out of prison, and his entire orientation was towards making people fear him. He'd sort of come to this place where this was the only way for him to protect himself because nobody else would protect him, and this is when he ended up going across town when someone owed him about $20 for a marijuana debt and was trying to make an example, was trying to sort of build a reputation for himself. And that was the night that that ended so tragically.
Do we know how he ended up in an adult penitentiary at 16?
He had intimidated a witness. He had actually assaulted another. And he had been in and out of juvie hall a few times, I believe. I think the judge decided, well, this clearly isn't taking, so we need to do something a little more serious.
We're speaking this hour with journalist Jeffrey E. Stern. His article, The Execution of Clayton Lockett, is the cover story in the June issue of The Atlantic magazine. We'll resume this conversation in a couple of minutes. You can join it by calling 1-800-933-5372. You can email think@kera.org, or you can find me on Twitter at Chris Boyd Think.
Funding for Think comes from SMU Summer Youth with hands-on workshops in robotics, Minecraft, game design, and visual arts for students entering K-12 at SMU's Plano campus. Online registration is available at smu.edu/summeryouth.
You're listening to Think on KERA 90.1. I'm Chris Boyd, speaking this hour with journalist Jeffrey E. Stern, author of the article The Execution of Clayton Lockett, which is the cover story in the June issue of The Atlantic magazine. Join us at 1-800-933-5372 or email think@kera.org. Let's go back to the phones now. We have James on the line in Dallas. Hello, James.
Hi. Thanks for taking the call.
Sure.
Yeah, I'm curious as to the demand for these types of execution drugs. It seems as though, you know, every time you hear of someone that gets a death sentence, they end up with life in jail. It takes 25, 30 years for them ever to even reach that point. So the execution drugs, am I missing something here? What is there really a demand out there for it? It's so few executions you ever hear of actually ever taking place.
That's a really interesting question. It's a good point. One of the reasons the pharmaceutical industry was able to act relatively aggressively eventually was because there was not a huge market for this. It's as a caller said, there were so few executions actually taking place that this wasn't a profit center for any pharmaceutical company that was making drugs that were used in executions. The thing is that it was so small and there was so little exposure to the drugs that were being used, there wasn't a huge downside. When states began using pentobarbital, the supplier, the company that was making it was a company called Lundbeck based in Copenhagen. They began getting a lot of attention. They had no interest in their drug being used in executions, but they weren't initially sure what to do about it. And eventually they acted fairly aggressively and proactively to keep drugs out of the hands of prisons by using something called essentially distribution controls, controlling who could get access to the drugs. But the reason they were able to do that was, again, I mean, it didn't matter to them. They weren't making a huge amount of money based on the handful of executions that were happening.
The point, I guess, is that it is bad PR for a drug company to say, we can save your life with this drug, but this one that we sell a little bit of is used deliberately to kill people.
All right. It's exactly anathema to the purpose of why they're making and advertising these products.
We have an email here from Rick who asks, how is it possible there's not enough of the drug available to perform these executions? Surely states or penal institutions would have obtained medications well in advance. Shouldn't the manufacturers of these medications be forced by law to produce these drugs? And I guess he's thinking about domestic manufacturers.
Well, sure. But I mean, remember that there's also expiration dates. And this is another problem that happened. So when, for example, Lundbeck put distribution controls on pentobarbital, states still had pentobarbital. But the shelf life is something like 2 years, or give or take, and eventually that ran out. So, you know, you can stockpile drugs, and some of these states did, and then a kind of black market emerged where they were trading with each other, states trading drugs with other states. But the drugs don't last forever. And also, it's actually, I mean, the shelf life on pharmaceutical products is a difficult thing to study, because if you think about it, I mean, what do? You use a drug 3 or 4 years after its shelf life and see if it works or not. There's not really a humane way to test that. So essentially, you could stockpile, but eventually the drugs are going to expire and it's going to be illegal to use them.
You talk about this bartering from state to state. You know, you have some of this and we'll trade it to you for this. One thing that rubbed at least opponents of the death penalty the wrong way was that it seemed to be done in a rather jovial way, or approached in a rather jovial way, by some of the parties involved in these trades.
Yeah, that's right. So there was a young journalist named Katie Fretland who was able to turn up some emails that officials in Oklahoma were sending back and forth to one another when Texas asked them for help getting a hold of pharmaceutical drugs, where they were talking about, you know, jokingly trading execution drugs for tickets to the football game, trying to convince Texas to somehow make the football team take a dive in the annual rivalry. So there was a fair amount of back and forth that was, as you say, you know, it was without context, looked very jovial, looked like they were not taking this seriously. Of course, I think, you know, this is also perhaps almost literally, you know, gallows humor, but it's still it's a shock. It's an upsetting thing to see when we're talking about, you know, literally life and death matters.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go next on the phone to Greg in Frisco. Hi, Greg.
Hi, Chris. Thanks for taking my call. I heard your question earlier about, you know, why do we care if the criminals are somewhat tortured when we execute them? And I find this question is not asked often enough, and I don't really see good answers in the press usually, but my response to that is simply that if we make the punishment, you know, disgusting and horrid and terrifying, then the people who commit the crimes that punishment is for tend to be more violent in the commission of those crimes because it's in their interest to destroy every witness, you know, blow up houses, burn them down, whatever, to try and avoid that horrific punishment. And it's something we've known for a long time. I mean, Jonathan Swift was writing back in the day about how, you know, hanging people for a loaf of bread was going against the common interest. And I think sometimes it's those kinds of questions and the sort of cavalier responses that people have that show that really we see the death penalty as a form of revenge as opposed to a form of, you know, of a judicial process. And I would like to get that comment out there so that people can think on that a little more deeply. Thank you for taking my call.
Thanks for your call, Greg. Is there anything there that you want to touch on or respond to, Jeff?
No, I think it's a great point. I'm thankful to Greg for making the comment. And I think with this piece, we really tried to stay away from the public policy aspect, which is obviously an incredibly important aspect of this, perhaps the aspect of this. But what we wanted to do was put a piece out there that would allow people like Greg to sort of make informed decisions and about based on what is really happening. So we did, and I would like to sort of stay away from the public policy aspect of this, but I think that is a really eloquent and important point.
Let's talk about this. I mean, when you are writing a piece like this one where the facts on all sides are very difficult and it's challenging, you know, certainly Clayton Lockett is not a hero. Many people would argue he's not a victim. And yet you have to tell the entire story in order to give people the information to make those informed choices. Was the writing and the editing of this piece more complex than what you would normally have in a story of this length?
I certainly believe so. I think it's really hard to treat someone like Clayton Lockett sensitively, while still understanding what he did and trying to understand the effect that had on his victims. It's a tricky thing intellectually. It's difficult emotionally, and I mean, fortunately, at the Atlantic has an incredible team of fact checkers and lawyers, and you know, it was one of these all hands on deck kind of projects where, and because we were dealing with such complex material and often conflicting information, we really needed an entire team to sort of make sure that we were telling exactly what happened with as much detail as we could, without using any detail that was potentially questionable. So the answer, the short answer is yes.
What's been the response of Oklahoma Governor Mary Fallon to the events of last year?
So Governor Fallon almost immediately, within I believe a day or two, held a press conference in which she reaffirmed her support for the death penalty, reminded everyone of the crimes that Lockett had committed, and then announced an investigation into the execution. She came in for a little bit of criticism because she had the Department of Public Safety, essentially the Highway Patrol, do the investigation, and the secretary reports directly to her. So there was some criticism for, you know, not bringing in an independent body, to which they responded that they wanted to find out what went wrong, correct it, and move on, and not begin a debate about the death penalty. They did. I mean, they did an investigation. The Department of Public Safety came out with some recommendations. They, you know, for example, they retrofitted the death chamber and they kept carrying out executions.
1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. We have Nicole on the line now in Fort Worth. Hello, Nicole.
Hi there. I just wanted to comment. I think it's interesting. Whenever I listen to any story, I always look, am I being led? Is somebody trying to maybe frame my perspective? And I noticed that when the initial crimes were discussed at the top of the show, two gunshot wounds, being buried, a rape, and a violent beating, there was no disclaimer. Now, hang on, this is going to be extremely graphic. But when the description of the lethal injection death before that, we were warned to brace ourselves because what was going to be described was going to be somewhat graphic. And what was described was, to me, far less graphic than the crimes that were discussed at the top of the hour. It was, you know, 16 attempts to insert an IV, and it sounds like maybe what was an hour of some voluntary or involuntary movement. And whether or not that's cruel and unusual punishment, I don't know. But I do feel like the way it was described, I was being led to believe that this was horrible and graphic, the way he died.
Well, Nicole,
so that's my thought.
I'm glad that you pointed that out, and to the extent that there was an oversight to point out that the crime itself was graphic, that was mine. The one thing I will say is that we have multiple living witnesses to describe what exactly happened in the execution of Clayton Lockett, and I don't know that we have as much information of the exact sort of the way that everything played out in those horrible crimes, but I do appreciate you pointing that out because it's an important point to make. 1-800-933-5372 is our telephone number. Let's go back to the phone now. We have Rasa on the line in Dallas. Hi, Rasa.
Hello there. How are you?
Very well, thanks.
My question has to do with this, with looking at the our execution protocols in light of the Right to Die movement. In recent years, we've had the Right to Die movement where people have been able to basically fulfill a prescription and be able to go home and take, you know, some concoction or something and die at home peaceably, as I understand it, perfectly at peace and comfortably. Is there some medical reason or some other reason why that does not work for execution?
I don't know if you looked into that at all, Jeff.
Yeah, well, I think, I don't know that this is the reason, but I think a reason is that if you are a patient who is seeking out a doctor to help you die peaceably, if that's something you believe in, then you're just that. You are a patient and the person is your doctor. They know, for example, you know, how big you are, how much you weigh, how potentially, you know, how fast you metabolize drugs. In this case, what we have is a doctor potentially in the death chamber who has never met the offender before, who has no idea any of those things, who's using drugs that maybe he or she doesn't even know. I mean, in this case, the doctor said, I had no interest in knowing what the drugs were. So, I mean, I think it's important to keep in mind that when we're talking about the death penalty, we're not talking about a doctor-patient relationship, even if there is a doctor in the room. And often, again, I mean, the person coming up with the drug cocktail is sometimes not a doctor at all, or a lawyer. So I think that these things are different probably for many reasons, but the one that's the most sort of crystal to me is the fact that, you know, a Dr. Kevorkian or something is dealing with patients, with people that he knows, people that have requested his assistance, and at least people that arguably he might know what drugs to use and in what doses.
We have an email here from Courtney who says, I am an ICU nurse and very familiar with the drugs you're discussing as well as IVs. To me, the problems with this execution seem to be related to the fact that the IV did not function. If there had been properly functioning IV access, would we even be discussing this execution? If the IV was working, Lockett would have gotten the drugs and they would have worked as they should. Midazolam is a frequently used and very effective sedative when the patient receives it.
Yeah, so I mean, I think this is an important point. I think there's two things that went that were problematic in this case, and we hesitated to put all of the blame on midazolam. Certainly, a big problem. Probably the bigger problem was the fact that the IV didn't function. But there are a lot of questions about midazolam, and my understanding is that when it's used surgically, it's rarely used by itself. It's often used with an analgesic drug, meaning a drug that actually addresses pain receptors. And, you know, there are problems it doesn't have – I'm sorry, it has a ceiling effect, meaning that if it's not working, you can't simply administer more. Sometimes there's a reverse effect. So there are potentially problems with midazolam, and I guess the final arbiter of that will be the Supreme Court. But I take the emailer's point that this was not all to do with one drug.
Capital punishment is on the books in 32 states. Only 17 of them have carried out an execution in the last 5 years. Does that suggest anything about the culture's tolerance for execution as a method of punishment?
You know, I mean, I would say I hesitate a little bit to sort of put my finger to the wind of the what people feel, but it does. But I will anyway. It does feel like we are, generally speaking, I mean, this is a huge generalization, but that we are potentially becoming less and less comfortable, and that's why we move to lethal injection, which is smaller and hopefully less of a spectacle. And I think that might be why, out of all the states that have this on the books, a relatively small proportion are actually carrying them out.
The article, The Execution of Clayton Lockett, is the cover story in the June issue of The Atlantic magazine, written by my guest, Jeffrey E. Stern. Jeff, thank you so much for spending this time with us.
Thank you, Chris. It was great to be with you.
Think is produced by Stephen Becker and engineered by Shelley Canavy. Lindsay Connect is associate producer. Jeff Whittington is executive producer. You can contact the show via email at think@kera.org. Once again, I'm Chris Boyd. Thanks for listening and have a great day.